Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We're getting an energy update as we are chatting with Joseph Schachter, founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. Also writes the Eye on Energy Report, which is a free letter that covers simply the fundamentals and the data within the energy, mostly oil and gas sector. Now, Joseph, I just simply want to start off here with a comment on the volatility that we have continued to see in the oil price. Oil, some days we've seen $10 moves. And look at something like yesterday, we saw a $10 move pretty much taken back all within one day. Now, a lot of these moves I still think are very much predicated on different headlines when it comes to the continuing war in Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia, no different than a lot of other markets, which are still headline driven, but there seems to be a lot more of a war premium or geopolitical premium that is in oil simply because of, well, Russia's dominance, not dominance, but large role in the energy sector. Joseph, what do you think the war premium or geopolitical premium still is in oil right now?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. These wild swings. On Monday, the reason, you know, that it had such the decline was, of course, when Zelensky said that he was open to not joining NATO and EU, but having security guarantees from Turkey, Poland, UK, Canada, if you recall. And they didn't mention the U.S., which is interesting. And people said, oh, maybe there's a move towards a peace treaty here. And Turkey is leading the talks with Russia and Ukraine. And that was where you saw the original decline in the price. But as you got through the day, you started hearing that there was more conditions there. And one of the one that, of course, Russia threw out was they wanted the official acknowledgement by Ukraine that Crimea was Russian. They wanted to have a referendum on the independence of the eastern part, the Donbas area, which, of course, I'm not sure Ukraine is keen on doing at all. Then the markets kind of gyrated based on, are they moving troops out of Kiev or are they just repositioning them to get them refueled and give them a little break from the front? So the market's going up and down. I think if you look at it in totality, I think there's still $30 to $40 of political and war premium in there. And the reason I'm concerned and why I think the lower price range is potentially, there once we get the war out of the way is a number of things. One, Russia is able to sell oil. Probably of the 4.5 million that they export, 2.5 million is going to China, India, and they're settling it in rubles and won. So there is no problem with the SWIFT. They're getting the oil sold, and they're coming from the Baltic, and they're selling it from the Black Sea and from Eastern Russia. So they are having buyers, and the buyers are happy to settle in won, and potentially the Chinese currency could end up being the number two currency in the world. Right now, it's a very small one. The U.S. dollar is the biggest. Euro is second. And then there's really a big gap between that and the third. China wants the yuan to be better even than the euro. So that's the game plan of China. Remember, China's economy is $18 trillion U.S. U.S. economy is $23 trillion. U.S. has, 340 million people in their population. China has 1.3, 1.4 billion. So in a few years, the Chinese economy will be bigger than the U.S. And so having the yuan as an acceptable currency, and they're already talking to Saudi Arabia of accepting the Chinese currency for sale. And that means the U.S. petrodollar loses its central power. And of course, if the U.S. dollar starts to weaken, then interest rates may have to go up even more, which, given the crazy inflation that's going on, be it food, be it transportation, be it shelter in the U.S., I think it's very likely that we're looking at a recession condition. And we already saw a couple of peaks over inversion where the short rates are trading above the 10-year and the longer rates. And that usually leads historically to recessions. And the next couple of weeks of economic news is going to be watched very quickly or carefully to see what's going on. And of course, Friday, we have an employment report in the state, so that'll be watched very carefully, especially by the Fed. And then some of these long-term inflation indicators the Fed watches are also going to be of concern.
Yeah, Joseph, you really outlined it well there. There's no shortage of different things pulling at the markets, whether it's the petrodollars weakening because of all the other oil being sold in other currencies, whether it's inflation, whether it's the Fed, whether it's the oil prices rising so much that could be recessionary, as well as the yield curve. Lots for investors to digest. But since you really are so focused on the energy sector, I'd love to get your thoughts on some of the bullish arguments that some people have proposed over the last couple of weeks, which is that, you know, the EIA just had their report come out and that there was a 3.4 million draw. And that was on the back of a 2.5 million draw the previous week and 3 million barrels draw. It was the estimate. So it was a little bit more than they expected. And then we continue to hear about the OPEC countries not even being able to make the 440,000 barrels a day target that they keep saying they want to hit. The countries can't even make it. So what do you make of those bullish arguments? Are those playing into the price at all? Is it just geopolitical, or are there legitimate supply issues?
Well, the draws that you're seeing still relate to winter demand. So winter demand usually stops sometime in March. And in April, May, and June, you have normally builds in storage. And then you have draws again during the summer, you know, electricity for air conditioning. And then you have builds again in September, October, and then November, December. And the peaks usually are January, February, when you have the peak demand. And that was probably about 100, 101 million barrels. But the drop off in April, May usually is 3 to 4 million barrels. So the draws you're seeing are legit, they're normal, they're seasonal. But we're heading into the seasonal sluggish season, the off season, where you're going to see inventory start to build up again. Remember, you know, if Saudi Arabia doesn't sell to Russia because Russia's, you know, or sorry, Saudi Arabia doesn't sell to China or India because they're buying $30 barrel a day, or, you know, U.S. $30 a barrel cheaper oil from Russia, they're going to have to find other buyers, which means they're, you know, we're going to see inventories build in other places around the world. And China and India are going to be buying the cheaply discounted oil, which, of course, their refiners are going to be very happy to do. In terms of the OPEC production, OPEC up to the month of February was holding back. Part of it, I think, was Saudi Arabia being annoyed at President Biden, because the crown prince, the president, had called him a murderer over the Khashoggi killing, and he had, and also the Houthi, issue with the battles going on in Yemen, and he just wasn't prepared to talk to him, and so the MBS, you know, was not willing to help out for it, and so if you look at the numbers for the month of January, the Saudis only added 54,000 of the. And the total was 64,000 by all of OPEC to 10 million barrels. In the month of February, they added 141,000, and you saw Nigeria increase, Libya increase, and the total increase by OPEC, and I've got the report right in front of me, was 440,000. So OPEC's now producing 28.5 million. So the volumes are beginning to come up. There's now pressure where you've got, you know, Britain going there, and Germany and France and others. So, you know, they're asking for an increase in the production because they would like to have the flexibility by the end of this year to not need as much Russian crude. And they're also dealing with Qatar and the U.S. on LNG. But they really, it's really all of the LNG that's coming out is all contracted under long-term contract. So what you need to do, and what Europe is trying to do, is saying to, you know, the Korean buyers or the Japanese buyers, or you know, can we get those volumes, and can you handle having less product just in case Russia cuts off our production? And here's really the nuance for April 1st is Putin has now said that all oil and natural gas effective April 1st has to be paid for in ruble, not U.S. dollars, and because of the SWIFT system, and we're not giving it to you for free. So if under the SWIFT system, or you know, you can pay it, but it goes into an account that Russia doesn't have access to, Russia says we're not being paid. And so they want to be paid in the ruble, which, you know, surprisingly, the ruble, which fell 50% on the sanctions and the SWIFT stuff, has now recovered, and it's now almost back to where it was prior to the invasion. And the other wild card is this week the Central Bank of Russia, whatever they call it, has said that they are now going to have the ruble convertible into gold. So if you remember, Nixon took the U.S. off the gold standard. You will now have Russia, the only country in the world, on the gold standard.
Really seems like Russia's okay with accepting whatever kind of cash or metals they can get for their gold or for their oil right now. Let's drive down into the stocks then, Joseph, because look, a number of these stocks, large and small, have done very well. Makes sense when we've seen this sort of appreciation in the underlying energy or oil price. How do you see these stocks set up? Do you see any as more a safe bet if oil does fall, or have you noticed any that haven't run with this higher oil price that you think maybe have some upside?
Well, I as you know, I've been cautious. You know, we were table bounding buyers in March of 2020, and for the last number of months, we've been or almost, you know, more than that, we've been in the cautious camp, because if it wasn't for the war premium that we see, the political premium we see, you know, and our concern about the, you know, recessionary conditions. And we write about it in our reports. The Eye on Energy that we're just finishing, I talk about the slowdown in economic activity that's occurring. Remember, China's now got Shanghai closed down, 25 million people. And then they've got, you know, Hong Kong and Beijing and other Shenzhen and other major cities shut down. And that's 20% of the GDP. Well, China imports 14 million barrels a day. 10 million barrels a day, consumes 14 million. Well, if you're importing 10 and you got a 20% of your economy going down, that's 2 million barrels a day of lost demand just in one country. And the question is for how long, but that's 2 million barrels a day. And so China's not buying as much oil as they were. And then if you look at Germany with the slowdown occurring there and the high prices, and then the EIA report today was quite something. U.S. demand fell, total demand fell 6% from 21.124 million, and I'm reading this straight off the report, down 1.25 million barrels on the day to 19.87. And distillates, which is, of course, used for heating oil because of the warmer weather, down 712,000 barrels a day to 3.8 from 4.52. So we're beginning to see. You can argue it's seasonal because of the warmer weather, that demand is falling off, which would be the traditional, as I mentioned earlier, 2 to 4 million barrel seasonal decline from the peak in the winter, and then you have the shoulder season, lower numbers. Or is this also high prices killing demand? So you've got demand destruction in China that's clearly evident from all the data. We're now seeing demand declines in the States, weather related, and also cost of living related. And so you then take it to Germany and Italy and France and other places around the world, and that 3 to 5 million barrel a day potential lower demand is possibly there. That offsets more than Russia's producing, and then we will start seeing inventory builds. And then again, we'll keep a war premium until we see something happen here. And I'm hoping there's something quickly, because, of course, the death toll is horrific. But I think Putin is planning to grab all of the eastern part of the country and the southern part of the country, which means he's got to get Mariupol, and then he's got to get Odessa, which means he effectively then controls the economic destiny of Ukraine, because they need those shipping ports to ship their grains, to ship their fertilizer, their tractors, whatever they make in the country. If they control those ports, they control the rest of Ukraine. So this is not over, and so the premium will stay for a while. But once that is over and some resolution is undertaken, I think we're going to see lower prices in Q3 as we see the economic impact. And remember, the Fed's tightening. Canada's raised interest rates. UK's raised interest rates. The inversion of the yield curve. And you watch consumer sentiment data from the Michigan survey. You watch almost regularly every week. There's 2-3 key reports that are showing a big slowdown in the U.S. And I think, you know, the biggest economy in the world shows that. China has it because of COVID. There's the reasons for lower prices at some point. But right now, the war premium and the swings that you were talking about as we started the broadcast, that's going to continue depending upon the news and the positive and negative news that comes out of those talks in Turkey.
Well, Joseph, even if the oil and even if the nat gas prices were to pull back some when some of this war premium comes out, there are some companies that have had debt covenants where they had to have big hedging contracts in place. And a lot of those hedging contracts are now rolling off. And so they're finally getting access to fatter margins and they're finally getting access to some of these higher prices. Could some of the oil and gas companies still run to the upside, even if there was a slight corrective move in the underlying price of the energy components, just because their margins are expanding?
Yeah, I think most of them are talking about that by, you know, last year's to a great extent, they rolled off. Others, Q1, they had hedge books and they're rolling off. But others are saying these commodity prices are way above what their budgets require. And their boards are saying, we're not in the gambling game or speculative game. We still need you to protect your CapEx budget and any, you know, the base dividend. So 20 to 40%, sometimes 50% of production in 2022 will still be hedged, but at much higher prices and done at the behest of companies wanting it, not at the behest of the arm twists of the banks to protect the banks' loans. So it's a different methodology today in terms of the hedge book. But the cash flows, I agree with you, will be much higher. And as companies report Q1 and Q2 results, companies that blow away the market's expectations should have resilience to the upside. But I would mention to you that when markets decline, and if there is a general stock market decline because of the inversion of the yield curve and an economic slowdown, if you look at the history of the tape of even the strongest energy companies in energy service and pipeline and infrastructure, when you have a market decline like 2008, 2009, Q1 of 2020 because of the pandemic, nothing can stand in the way of a market decline. Everything gets beat up.
It is true. Everything pulls back when we see investors broadly fleeing. And look, it doesn't matter how good the company looks financially, the stock price usually does go down. But I think it is encouraging to see and know that a lot of these energy companies are paying off debt and are building a bit better financial position. So that can help at least weather some of the storm of a major market correction, which who knows if we're going to get that this year, but definitely those calls have grown in terms of a major correction. Joseph, wrap us up. One more comment here, buddy.
Yeah, I really like the sector longer term. I think the next 4 or 5 years are going to be fabulous for the sector because of the security of supply issues that we're doing. And especially natural gas, because of the cleanest of all the fossil fuels, natural gas is going to do extremely well. So focus your investment opportunities when we get the buying signal that we hope to have by Q3 towards the natural gas sector, which is what our view is, and that's what we've done personally, and we're going to go and add more to those names. So a market correction can happen in 1 month, it can happen over 3-4 months, but once that is underway and it exhausts itself, you want to have a big shopping list of names, and that's where I think people should do their homework. And again, you know, read our Eye on Energy, which gives you the macro view, or, you know, if you're a subscriber to our product and cover 30 companies, you can build up your shopping list and be ready to be buyers. My guess is sometime in Q3 that window will happen and the bell will ring and we'll have another great buying opportunity. Definitely not as good as March of 2020, but maybe as good as March of 2009.
Okay, there we go. Joseph, thank you as always for your time. Again, Joseph is the founder and editor of the Schachter Energy Report. We will be following up with Joseph next month and cover more of the moves in the energy sector, some of the stocks, and what's truly driving the moves in oil and gas. Joseph, thank you as always for your time, buddy. I hope you have a great rest of your week.